From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, this is Darielle Delgado with your WSLR News headlines for Sunday, July 5th. Immigrant advocacy groups are condemning Florida's new ban on undocumented students attending state colleges and adult education programs. The rule, approved this week by the State Board of Education, prohibits students without legal immigration status from enrolling in state public colleges. Advocates call the move cruel and harmful, arguing it will deny educational opportunities to students who have grown up and graduated from Florida schools. State leaders say the policy prioritizes educational resources for legal residents. Manatee County officials say cleaning local waterways to reduce flooding risk could cost taxpayers another $18.8 million to finish the job. The county has already spent more than $10 million cleaning debris and vegetation from canals and rivers following severe flooding caused by Hurricane Debby in 2024. Officials say 11 drainage systems still need major cleanup work, with ongoing maintenance expected to cost around $2 million each year. County leaders say the effort is critical to protecting homes and improving stormwater flow ahead of future storms. According to Suncoast Searchlight, Manatee County Commission Chairman Tal Sadiq is proposing that more than $2.5 million be returned to the school district of Manatee County. Commissioner Sadiq says the money, which was withheld to cover property tax collection fees, should instead support local classrooms and teachers. The proposal comes after state lawmakers approved a fix allowing counties to waive those fees. The commission is expected to consider the reimbursement plan later this month. The city of Sarasota is launching a new pilot program aimed at making biking easier and more accessible. Five micro-mobility hubs funded through a federal grant are being installed across the city. Each location will include bike racks, repair stations, and air pumps, along with fruit-themed designs to pay tribute to Sarasota's historic street names. The first hub is now open near Ringling Boulevard and South School Avenue, with four additional locations planned as part of the city's transportation master plan, Sarasota in Motion. This has been Darielle Delgado with your WSLR News headlines for Sunday, July 5th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini. Thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Tomorrow will mark the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, ostensibly the moment the United States of America cast off colonial bonds to become a free country. Well, free for some, and still working on freedom for all its citizens. Meanwhile, in a ruling that never should have been considered, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of birthright citizenship in a squeaker 5-4 decision. I say never should have been considered because aside from the minority of Americans that unfortunately includes the President of the United States, the principle that anyone born in the United States automatically became a citizen was not in question. Stay tuned until 1:30 to hear my interview with Amy Bott, Executive Director of the Suncoast Chapter of Bernie's Book Bank, a nonprofit organization that distributes free, high-quality books to children up to the sixth grade. The Suncoast Chapter kicked off its presence with an event in Sarasota in April. But first, The ruling in the birthright citizenship case may have grabbed the headlines, but the more important ruling regarding the health of our democracy was one that further unleashed the flood of money in politics by striking down limits on the amount of money political committees can spend in coordination with individual candidates. The Supreme Court this week ditched one of the remaining checks on money in politics, a decision in line with recent rulings favoring free speech rights over fears about potential corruption. Overruling the decision that lasted a quarter of a century, the High Court sided 63 with Republicans, including Vice President J.D. Vance, who challenged a more than 50-year-old rule capping how much parties can spend in coordination with candidates. The campaign spending rule aimed at preventing wealthy donors from bypassing limits on what they can give to federal candidates by funneling money through political partners was passed in 1974 as part of Congress's response to the Watergate scandal and upheld by the Supreme Court in 2001. The nation's high court issued its campaign finance ruling with the November midterm elections looming as Republicans seek to retain control of Congress. Writing for the court's conservative majority, Justice Brett Kavanaugh said the decision treats all political parties equally. Both parties can now participate more freely and compete more fully in the political process, he wrote. Rejecting concerns about political corruption, Kavanaugh said that there are other checks to prevent that, including disclosure rules. In dissent, Justice Elena Kagan said the majority jettisons rule needed to protect our democracy's integrity. The court's decision may benefit the GOP, at least in the short run, because many Democratic candidates have not relied as much on financial help from political parties as they have been better at attracting small-dollar donations. The three major Republican committees, the Republican National Committee, the National Republican Congressional Committee, and the National Republican Senatorial Committee, ended May with $2,600 million in cash and no debt. That is more than double the roughly $2,600 million held by Democratic counterparts, who also carried more than $18 million in debt, Reuters reported. Advocates fighting the influence of deep-pocketed donors fear Republicans will use their victory to go after the remaining campaign finance restrictions. The Supreme Court has been chipping away at spending and contribution limits, ruling that there are improper restrictions on political speech under the First Amendment. Major decisions included the 2010 ruling in the case called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which paved the way for the creation of independent political action committees known as super PACs. Republicans argued that leading donors have been turned to super PACs because they can receive unlimited donations. That has turned super PACs into shadow parties, diminishing the role of actual political parties, the GOP said. And Republicans say there is no evidence that restricting how much parties can spend in consultation with a candidate prevents corruption. That's why no one has identified a single case in which a donor has actually laundered a bribe to a candidate through a party's coordinated spending, even though 28 states allow it. Noel Francisco, a lawyer representing the GOP, told the court during a December oral arguments. But Mark Elias, an attorney for the Democratic Party, said getting rid of limits would leave little protection against donors seeking favors. Both parties and super PACs can spend as much as they want to help a candidate as long as they don't coordinate with the candidate. Parties could also spend limited amounts at the direction of candidates. When a party pays for an ad at the request of a candidate, the court said in its 2001 decision upholding the coordinated spending limit, that expenditure has the same effect as a direct contribution to the candidate, so it, therefore, can be regulated. And because donors can give more to parties than they can to candidates, donors might use parties to get around lower limits, increasing the possibility that a backer might expect something in return for the support, the court previously ruled. According to Republicans, America needs to watch out for socialists. With members of the Democratic Socialists of America winning congressional seats in New York City last week, a lot of Republicans have seized upon fresh material to motivate their base and what could become a tough political environment for the GOP in this fall's midterm election. That was a major theme of the Republican Party of Florida's Sunshine State Showdown this weekend at Seminole Hard Rock Hotel in Hollywood, which is actually in Davie. The communists that just got elected in New York and in California and in Illinois, well, they're banking on you not getting out the vote, the Gainesville area Republican U.S. Rep. Kat Kamek said. They want you to stay home. They are anarchist psychos who want to destroy the country, added U.S. Senator Ashley Moody on the ballot for the first time this year as a senator after being appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis last year to fill the seat left by Marco Rubio. Moody fretted that the National Democratic Party had been taken over by these crazy people who do not believe in what this country is and wonder whether anybody in the Democratic establishment could stop what she sees as an ominous takeover. Hakeem, Barack, Kamala, Ilhan, Zoran, I don't know if one of them is the leader. I don't know who it is, but none of them will speak out to that, to what those crazy anarchists are saying. None of them will speak out against it and should tell you all you need to know, she said. Florida Chief Financial Officer Blazing Goglia also said the statewide ballot this fall after also on the statewide ballot this fall after being appointed to his position a year ago by DeSantis, said Florida's reputation as a beacon of hope, freedom, and opportunity in a world that's gone completely mad was at stake if Republicans didn't get to the polls in November. Because the modern Democratic Party is the party of batshit crazy, I'm sorry to say. They just elected a communist mayor, Zoran Mandami. They nominated somebody in Texas, James Talrico, who thinks God is non-binary. They nominated a person in Maine, Graham Plattner, who has a Nazi symbol on their chest, wants to rape home intruders. They also just nominated a congressional candidate in New Jersey, Adam Hamaway, who helped a terrorist defend himself in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And just this week alone, they nominated not one, not two, but three show socialists in New York. Brian Lander, one of the three New Yorkers who won the Democratic primaries last week, is no longer a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. U.S. Rep. Randy Fine predicted impeachment hearings for President Trump will take place immediately if the Democrats win back the House in November and said the wheels of government will grind to a halt. Kamek echoed that sentiment, adding every single cabinet member will be dragged in front of the Congress for 24/7 hearings in front of a rabid, radicalized Congress. The lead-up to Saturday's gathering of party faithful had concentrated on the disappointment and anger felt by some party members, including Governor Ron DeSantis, after party leaders announced earlier this month that there would be no gubernatorial debate during this event. That was only because one of the candidates, U.S. Rep. Byron Donalds of Naples, had met the pre-established criteria of reaching at least 10% support in the official party poll, raised more than $10 million, and secured more than 10,000 donors. Party officials instead offered individual speaking times for all of the top-ranked competitors to Donalds. The event climaxed with Donalds as the closer. His presentation began with a short video clip showing the late conservative activist Charlie Kirk endorsing him for Florida governor. Donalds then announced that in the spirit of Kirk's engagement with students at college campuses, he would invite Republicans who shelled out the $150 to attend the event to ask him a question. Before that happened, though, Donalds offered his own remarks and detailed plans if elected in the fall and laying out the campaign strategy of depicting likely Democratic gubernatorial nominee David Jolly as a man who is running as a moderate but will govern to left if given the keys to the governor's mansion. is going to campaign in the most boring way possible, Donald said. Probably going to turn the channel because it's boring. Let me tell you, the boring part is not a bug. It's a feature. The Democrats understand very clearly that they cannot campaign on their radical agenda because the people of Florida will reject it soundly. So what they'll campaign on is being nice and trying to sound normal. But we've seen this campaign before. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. As the subsidies subside, solar energy is getting more expensive. U.S. solar developers have secured federal subsidies for a wave of projects large enough to nearly double current capacities, rushing to beat the July 4th deadline that could send renewable power costs sharply higher. The projections reflect the loss of valuable renewable energy tax credits worth at least 30% of project costs, a change that threatens to raise U.S. energy prices amid surging demand driven by artificial intelligence. The phase-out of the 20-year-old subsidies accelerated under President Donald Trump's 2025 tax law could drive contract prices for wind and solar energy up by 40 to 50%, with early data from Texas showing prices for some deals up 120%, according to analysis by Level 10 Energy. The shift comes as the Trump administration policy seeks to slow renewable energy development, increasingly reliance on fossil fuels despite natural gas turbine supply bottlenecks and mounting pressure for federal support for coal. Trump has repeatedly argued that renewable energy sources like solar and wind are too expensive, receive unfair subsidies, and are less reliable than fossil fuels because they depend on the wind blowing or the sun shining. President Trump's priority is expanding base load power for the American people, and he will continue to unleash reliable, affordable, and secure energy, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers said in an email. The looming tax credit loss has created a pipeline of more than 200 gigawatts of solar capacity with credits effectively secured, according to energy resource firm Woods Mackenzie, nearly enough to double the current U.S. solar fleet. Solar is the fastest growing U.S. electricity source. Buyers that fail to secure contracts with projects in the pipeline will face higher costs. It should give caution to folks that are waiting on the sidelines, said Connor Valick, a senior manager at Level 10, which connects renewable electricity sellers and buyers. The future is not the rosiest with this tax credit cliff. The data is preliminary because project developers have rushed to preserve tax credit eligibility by safe harboring, which means they can include starting site construction work, buying key equipment, logging worker hours, or spending a portion of the project's costs before July 4th. Under federal tax rules, there is a 4-year window to complete those facilities, many of which are still seeking buyers for their power. Contract proposals are increasingly including subsidy-free cost estimates because projects in early stages of development may not be able to clinch the tax credit eligibility, Level 10 said. Even without subsidies, utility scale, solar and onshore wind are the cheapest forms of energy generation, according to a 2025 analysis by the investment firm Lazard Community. And industrial solar installations are competitive with natural gas and nuclear powered plants. Solar project developers say that their silver lining is that the renewable energy, excluding tax credits, will be less expensive than the retail power in the coming years due to soaring electricity prices driven by data center demands. We can initiate projects at the same level of profitability in 3 years that we can today because of the price of energy has already escalated so dramatically in the areas that we're doing business in with no sign of slowing down, said John Winchell, CEO of Durango, Colorado-based commercial solar developer King Energy. Now that Alligator Alcatraz is closing, the state emergency fund is back to paying for emergencies. Florida's emergency response fund, a massive pot of cash used to foot hundreds of millions in Alligator Alcatraz bills, can now resolve all financial obligations drawn down since February, according to a new law Governor Ron DeSantis quietly signed this week. SB 7040 recreates Florida's Emergency Response and Preparedness Fund, a trust allowing the governor to quickly pay for declared disasters, including immigration, without legislative approval. It expired in February after lawmakers couldn't agree on whether to rein in emergency spending. DeSantis's approval behind closed doors after a budget signing press conference came days after Florida's emergency managers told the legislature they were spending an additional $91 million out of the fund for immigration activities. This brings the grand total spent between June and February to $567 million. That lengthening tab is just a fraction of the $1 billion in contracts and tens of millions more shelled out for one-time immigration costs like supplies, travel, and food. CBS Miami reported the daily rate to keep the Everglades Immigrant Detention Center running was 20 times higher than U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's national average. With the bill's approval, the Florida Division of Emergency Management will be able to pay the rest of the immigration bills, which include more than $600 million to contractors who built and operated the state's detention centers. In the waning days of the regular session, after disagreeing about how tightly regulated the fund should be, lawmakers finally agreed to recreate the trust with a few new guardrails. Now, the trust can't be used to purchase boats, aircraft, or motor vehicles, but they can be leased for a short time, SB 740 says. This comes amid millions in expenditures at transportation companies, including hundreds of millions on private jets to and from the Everglades Center. The law also requires the Joint Legislative Budget Commission to review every time the governor extends a state emergency with one caveat. The chair and vice chair of the commission can waive approval if the governor is redeclaring a man-made or technological emergency like immigration. The budget commission is made up of state senators and representatives with authority to tinker with the budget between sessions. Other provisions include a separate account within the emergency fund for federal disbursement, reimbursement deposits, an expiration date of July 1st, 2028, a quarterly report on spending and the financial health of the fund, an earlier version required FDEM's executive director to sign off on the report under penalty of perjury, but that portion was stripped out before the final passage. There's $89 million left in the fund for the remainder of the fiscal year, which ended June 30th. In the budget, lawmakers agreed to pump another $250 million into the trust starting July 1st. Lawmakers created the emergency fund in 2022 to pay for responses, costly and disastrous hurricanes, flooding, or tornadoes. Months later, however, DeSantis declared a state of emergency for immigration, opening the trust to immigration enforcement activities. He's extended that state of emergency every 60 days since. Renaming airports is not free. Florida will spend $2.75 million on renaming Palm Beach International Airport after President Donald Trump after Governor Ron DeSantis declined to include the earmark among his $1.6 billion in vetoes. The non-recurring funds, which lawmakers agreed to during the special budget session last month, will cover the cost of campus-wide signage replacements, equipment and vehicle rebranding, uniform and marketing updates, and changes to overhead announcements, emergency messaging, and passenger processing systems. DeSantis signed the budget, which totaled $117.6 billion during a news conference before signing. The governor said he prioritized funding things that we have to have while vetoing items either inappropriate or maybe nice to have. He did not specifically address the soon-to-be-rechristened Donald J. Trump International Airport. But even before Monday's budget signing, it appeared all but certain that the rebranding would succeed. In March, DeSantis signed legislation, HB 919, approving the renaming. Palm Beach Gardens Rep. Meg Weinberger dubbed MAGA Meg for the support she has shown and received from Trump and his backers, sponsored the measure in the House with St. Augustine Rep. Kim Kendall, a fellow Republican. This is a tribute to the leadership, to his leadership, his legacy, Weinberger told Florida Politics about the bill, adding that the airport's proximity to Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort made the designation appropriate. You know how much he loves our country, and it's his hometown. Melbourne Republican Senator Debbie Mayfield, who also carried the state appropriation request, sponsored the bill's Senate companion. The House passed the measure 81-30, while senators approved it 25-11, both on party line votes. Notably, the rebranding is a departure from historic norms. While U.S. airports have been named after former presidents during their lifetimes, including Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, there has not been previously a case of a major airport being named for a sitting president. It has happened outside of America, including in Nigeria, which named an airport in Mina after President Bola Ahmed Tinubu in 2024. In mid-February, Republicans in the Senate blocked an amendment by Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Chevron Jones aimed at preventing Trump from profiting off the airport's name. County officials who approved the renaming last month estimated the necessary work would reach about $5.5 million. Mayfield sought that exact sum. The legislature ultimately decided on half of that. No one looked at the presidency as a money-making opportunity until now. President Donald Trump reported more than $1.4 billion in income from his family's crypto ventures last year, showing how Trump now derives most of his income from digital assets that have benefited from his policies, according to a review of his latest financial disclosures. His annual disclosure for 2025 at the U.S. Office of Government Ethics detail the fact that his companies received almost $800 million from World Liberty Financial, a crypto venture he and his sons co-founded, that concluded more than $520 million from sales of crypto tokens and more than $250 million from sale of interests in World Liberty Business, with family members also due a share of that income. Trump reported another $635 million from the sale of his Trump meme coins. The disclosure underlines how crypto has transformed the president's income. In his disclosure last June, for example, the president reported $57.35 million from token sales at World Liberty, which then leaped to more than $500 million in this year's filings. A judge this week blocked President Donald Trump and Trump's administration from implementing a new rule stripping public service workers of eligibility for federal student loan forgiveness if it deems their employers to have a substantial illegal purpose. U.S. District Judge Myon Jung in Boston sided with Democratic-led states, cities, and nonprofits that argued that the Department of Education's rule would allow it to target groups supporting immigration rights, transgender health care, and other causes the Trump administration disfavors by disqualifying them from the public service loan forgiveness program. The program allows borrowers to have their federal student loans forgiven after 10 years working for the government or nonprofit employers. Trump has argued the program has been exploited by activist organizations that harm U.S. national security and values and ordered the Education Department to narrow eligibility. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is my interview with Amy Bott, Executive Director of the Suncoast Chapter of Bernie's Book Bank.
I'm Lou Larini, and I'm happy to welcome Amy Bott, Executive Director of the Florida Suncoast Chapter of Bernie's Book Bank, an organization that has supplied nearly 40 million free quality books to children since 2010, and it's officially expanded into the Florida Suncoast community, intending to provide over 300,000 children with free, high-quality books to call their own. Hey, thanks for coming on the show, Amy. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Happy to be here. Thanks, Lou.
Great. You know, tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you came to Bernie's Book Bank.
Absolutely. So I'm a former educator myself. I taught in the Sarasota County School District for over a decade. And I know firsthand that this community is incredibly committed to the education of our Suncoast children. I've seen firsthand in my classroom, I taught high school science, full disclosure, not English and not elementary school. But I did see the effects then of when a 16-year-old came into my earth science class. And, you know, reading was a struggle for them, and they struggled in my classroom, and I knew they struggled in all of their classes. And they honestly had a harder time than the students that had a earlier shot at reading, at reading on grade level. What we would see then is the children that had, and I'm talking about teenagers now, so these teenagers that had reading scores on or above their level, you know, they saw the world as full of opportunity. They saw it as having doors open for them instead of closing. And I saw joining Bernie's Book Bank as an opportunity to multiply that impact and be able to get to the children earlier, supply them with books in their home. And look, we know that book ownership is a stronger predictor of a child's success than their parents' own education levels. Here on the Suncoast, we have some communities that that need the support, that they need support in providing books for their children. So we're happy to be here to do that.
Great. You know, it sounds like those are kind of the driving principles, behind the foundation of this organization. Tell us a little bit about that history. Who founded it? A gentleman named Brian Florian, I guess, in the Milwaukee area?
Yes. So Brian Floriani, he founded Bernie's Book Bank in Chicago in 2009. Yeah, Brian, people often ask us, who is Bernie? Dr. Bernie Floriani was Brian's father, who, he was never found without a book, and he read his way to a better life. So, now at this point, Brian, he founded this organization, by the way, in his garage in 2009. Since then, I'm happy to share, just earlier this month, we've surpassed over 32 million books distributed in our three markets. It has been exciting time these past 4-5 years, as they did expand into Milwaukee. And then, of course, now here, last school year was our first year of distributions. What we've done is streamlined our operations. We're able to source books at large quantities and able to get them into the hands of children that need them most. And honestly, we are not stopping. Now we are excited to expand further. Our goal is to make it so that way no children in this country are without a book if they need them. So we're excited, and I'm proud to continue that legacy of Brian and his father down here on the Suncoast.
And now I guess this Florida Suncoast chapter is the third chapter, because, of course, the first one was in Chicago, the Chicagoland chapter, I suppose, and then you moved to Greater Milwaukee, I guess.
Yes, correct. Yeah, so then we're the third one. And it's been a really fun year for me getting to get back into the classroom and you know, get to get down on carpet time and read with the kids. It is, Lou, you have no idea how exciting it is to these kids when I get in there and we bring a bag of books in the bright green bags. We provide new, free, high-quality books to these children at 24 schools this past year in Sarasota County and in Manatee County. And when we get, you know, I hand them that bag and I say, hey, these are yours. These are your books to take home, and you don't have to bring them back. And you can even write your name on the inside cover. And Lou, you would not believe how excited these kids are. They look at me like their minds are blown, like, I don't have to return this. This is mine. And one kid even, he was just the best. He got so excited, and you could tell his teacher normally tells him to sit in his seat and stay seated. And he was fighting it because he was so excited. He was like, it's like Christmas. He was thrilled to get these books. And I can't tell you how fun it is for me to personally get back in the classroom and share in that book joy.
Yeah, and I guess it's important to note that this Florida Suncoast chapter did kick off here in Sarasota. You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't note that was the beginning of it, I guess, on April 14th, an event.
Yeah, they did do a kickoff. Yeah, it was really a wonderful event. We had a task force that kind of pulled some people together, community members, nonprofit, and people from the community foundations, the education foundation, and the school districts, just to really kick off like what it means and to be a partner here on the Suncoast. We're excited to partner with other, with not just with the school districts, but other nonprofits. We did supply books to every single child enrolled at a site for Children First of Sarasota this past year as well. So our impact really grew from just the elementary school. Now we supply books from birth through fifth grade here on the Suncoast this coming school year. So very excited about that.
Okay. Let's get down to the nuts and bolts about how the program works. You know, how are places to donate books picked, and what's that process to get those books to those places, and what are book drives? What are some other things that I need to know, or that my listeners need to know about how this program works and actually, you know, collects books and then gets them in the hands of kids that want them?
Yeah, thank you. Well, we work directly with the school districts of Sarasota County Schools and School District of Manatee County to identify the schools to ensure that we're getting the books in the hands of the kids that need them most. Through that partnership with the districts, we distribute throughout the school year. So while this is, of course, a slow season for us, while our schools are out, we do have a summer book drive going on right now. We have partnered with Gecko's Restaurants in Sarasota County and Manatee County as well, starting this weekend. There are book receptacles in the lobbies of every single Gecko's Restaurant in Sarasota County and Manatee County starting tomorrow, July 1st. So families around the area, if you have some gently loved books at your home for children from birth through sixth grade, We will take those books and repurpose them and get them into the hands of a child who needs them, so they can have a new life and be read for many years.
Yeah, that was kind of you anticipated my next question about whether, you know, used books would count, you know, if they were in pretty good shape, and what the sort of age group is, I guess, for books, because I guess mm-hmm. I guess you're aiming at sort of elementary school age children getting their first book.
Actually, birth through sixth grade. Yeah, so since we do partner with some of the child care providers like Children First and Head Start program, we're able to also make sure we're supplying books to children, our youngest children on the Suncoast, to help have those early interventions. Something that we know, of course, from years of research and just personally as a parent and an educator myself, when most of the nonprofits, the coalitions around here, we're working towards supporting children to get them on reading on grade level before that key benchmark of third grade. Third grade is a big milestone for kids. Children in third grade are learning to read still, and then they switch to fourth grade where then they're reading to learn. So we really, anytime we can have earlier intervention, we will try and take full advantage of that, providing books to children at child care centers and other distribution partners like Children First.
You know, who are some other Bernie's book banks partners, you know, from both the corporate and publishing worlds, and do they supply a lot of books?
Sure. So we have some wonderful partners at the national level that support our work. What we do with sourcing and processing and distributing all of these books, we do it through generous donors, committed companies, and of course, partners and volunteers. Here locally, we do have some partners in the nonprofit space as well that help us get the books out into community. Besides Geckos is a wonderful partner to help us with our summer book drive. But we do have United Way Suncoast programs to help us get books out through their summer reading program, summer care, and other things that they do for that. To get books into the hands of kids over the summertime. That's a key issue a lot of times with children as they go home and end up needing to have more access to books, more activities, and some support so they don't lose all of the learning gains that they got over the school year.
Great. For those just tuning in, this is WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. And I'm speaking with Amy Bott, Executive Director of the Florida Suncoast Chapter for Bernie's Book Banks. Okay, what is a book desert?
Well, book deserts are a term that's been coined years ago by another organization. It's just referring to exactly what it sounds like, areas down to the micro communities through larger regions, referring to areas that books are sparse and hard to come by for those children in that area.
Yeah, I know. This is a little off the track, but you know, one of the saddest anecdotal things that I had heard. I knew a teacher who taught kindergarten at a school that served one of the lower income communities in Manatee County, and she told me that there were many of her students, this kindergarten now, that came to class that had never seen written material, had never seen a magazine, had never seen a book, had never held a pencil or a crayon. And she said, you know, you talk about somebody starting their life, sort of 8 steps behind the start line than everybody else. I mean, isn't that kind of what we're attacking here or what you're trying to approach here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned earlier that third grade seems to be the indicator for future success. It is mirrored by kindergarten readiness scores here on the Suncoast. Locally, we see close to 50% of students, I think it's around 46% of the counties that we serve, are not reading on grade level at third grade, and then that's mirrored into the kindergarten readiness scores locally. We can also trace that into future success. A child who is not reading on grade level by third grade, they are four times more likely to drop out of high school. There are long-term academic success correlations along with even just like lifetime earning potential that they'll have. And then the children's children's lifetime earning potential. There's a lot of studies and work that has gone into just demonstrating the effect of reading literacy at a young age. And I always think about, you know, third grade is a key benchmark. Sure, what happens to a child between birth and third grade is not equitable and not their fault. And I'm happy to be able to support in any way I can to provide books to those kinds of children that maybe don't have books in their home, don't have access to high quality, engaging, fun to read books.
Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, from what I see, some of that, some of those conclusions that you just mentioned, I think, are borne out by a recent 5-year study you all conducted, you know, about the impact of Bernie's Book Bank.
It was
in Wisconsin, right? It was in Milwaukee.
Correct. Yes. Bernie's this bank is committed to not only, you know, providing books to children. We also want to make sure that we're operating like a business, even though we're a nonprofit. We do want to think about ROI of our generous donors and supporters. It's important to us and to our mission that we understand the effectiveness of our program. So we participated in a randomized control trial. 60 schools in the Milwaukee Public School District. The children in that district that received Bernie's Book Bank books, they gained a quarter to a third of a year's in additional reading growth. And for those of your listeners that are parents or educators that know, that is a huge number. And to say that this program, it was just from receiving the books, that was the only intervention difference in this randomized control trial. The children that just got a bag of books from us once a year, and that was at $16 a child annually, that investment helped rewrite a children's story. When that study was expanded to over 5 years, when you look at the impact of a child who received our books for 5 years throughout the study, the effect was compounded. Those children who received our books for 5 years, they had a 50% to two-thirds of a school year's worth of learning gains as compared to their peers who did not receive the bag of books that year. So it is clear that our program works. We knew intuitively going into this, giving books to kids is a good idea, that it is it's the right thing to do, and that it helps. Now we have some data to demonstrate that efficacy of our program. So we know it works, and we're excited here on the Suncoast to offer that intervention to as many children that we can get to.
Terrific. You know, I don't know. I guess. This question has to be asked because you are operating in Florida. Is this recent increase, well, recent the last few years, in banning books or politicizing book content, how does that affect you, particularly here in Florida?
All I can say is we're laser focused on building the home libraries for children. We know that it is about access and ownership. That randomized control trial definitely demonstrates that. What I can speak to is that that's what we're working on and what we're focused on. And it, it's we're not going to stop there. We'll continue to provide books to children in that fashion.
Okay, so you know you're not affected. Your selection, you know, is it skewed in any way? I mean, you know, I know you get, you know, some partnership with governmental agencies. You know, is the state of Florida saying anything to you about, you know, what you can include in those greenbacks?
No, we just work directly with the school districts, and okay. They, you know, that's all that we do to ensure that we're all good there, and that the kids are getting the books that they need.
Okay, mm-hmm. Great. You know, so it's just basically, it's not really an issue for you. You know, because as I must say, you know, while, you know, it seems like there are a lot of books being banned, you know, that are, you know, the kids ought to read, there are also a lot more that aren't being banned that they ought to read, too. So, you know, a lot of fish in the sea, right?
We're happy to provide a large variety of books to children. It's one thing that is really fun about what we do is the books come in green bags that are mixed titles in the classroom. So the teachers allow them, you know, 15 minutes or so. We get to, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we get down on the carpet with them and we'll look at them. They get excited, but, you know, we'll give them time to trade. And you should see the bartering that goes on. We've got some future traders in the room, but they're hilarious and they get really excited about books you might not think they would be interested in. There was one that was, I specifically remember there was a book that was about mushrooms, and like it was a, you know, nonfiction book about, you know, the amazing fungi of the world, which, you know, me as a former science teacher, I do think that's pretty cool, but I wouldn't think that would be a hot hit in the classroom. And but man, those kids were wanting it. There was trading going on. They were excited about the mushroom book. So you never know what these kids are going to want to read, whatever sparks their imagination, whatever resonates with them. We're excited to be able to be in that room with them and sharing in the book joy.
That's a great story. You know, why don't you tell my listeners, you know, how they can learn more about Bernie's Book Bank and volunteer to help?
Yes, absolutely. Well, right now, you can just anytime go to berniesbookbank.org. And find out more about our organization as a whole, or under the Our Impact tab, Florida Suncoast is there with local information. Follow us on social media channels, which is at Bernie's Book Bank. We're on Instagram and Facebook, and I think our social media manager got us on TikTok. I'm not quite sure, though. I'm a little old for that, but I know that some she might have got us on there. But yeah, that'd be great. And then also, if anyone over the summer is doing some summer cleaning and has some gently loved books from birth through fifth grade, we would love to have you stop by any Gecko's restaurant in Sarasota or Manatee County. There'll be a box in the lobby. You can drop them off, and we will make sure that those books get a second life and read by children that need them.
Fantastic. You know, I want to thank you, Amy Bott, for making time for us today. And, you know, best of luck with Bernie's Book Bank, the Suncoast chapter. Thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you, Lou.
Great. Have a good day.
Yeah.
Bye.
A new grassroots group has been founded to warn voters about the danger posed by the property tax amendment. A newly formed political committee is stepping into Florida's intensifying debate over property taxes, urging voters to take a closer look at Governor Ron DeSantis's backed proposed constitutional amendment. The group warns that the measure could have far-reaching consequences for local governments across the state. Calling itself a grassroots effort, 3 Degrees Florida said it is not against property tax relief. Instead, the group is sounding the alarm that an amendment could make it harder for local governments to pay for essential services if it passes. The group's branding draws heavily on the Titanic disaster. It notes that 11:03 p.m. on April 14th, 1912, the ship was about 37 minutes from striking the iceberg and argues that a change in course of barely 3 degrees would have been enough to avoid the iceberg. Florida faces a similar moment today, the campaign says. The 3 degrees campaign is not about preserving the status quo. It's about making a prudent course correction before Florida collides with unintended consequences that will be difficult and very expensive to reverse. The launch comes as opposition to the proposed constitutional amendment begins to organize. Until recently, sponsors largely controlled the public conversation surrounding the property tax relief. But with 3 degrees Florida joining the previously announced vote no on 3 campaign, voters are beginning to hear competing argument that while cutting property taxes may be popular, eliminating a major source of local government revenue without a replacement funding plan could carry significant consequences for cities, counties, and the services they provide. We're not asking Florida residents to vote against property tax relief, the organization states on its website. We're asking them to look one step beyond what's being proposed. What happens after the property tax cut? At the heart of the committee's message is a warning. Cutting property tax revenue without a clear plan to replace those dollars could leave local governments facing tough choices. That could mean cuts to public safety, infrastructure, libraries, parks, and other services that communities rely on every day. A lower property tax bill isn't a bargain if you end up paying more everywhere else, the group's website states. The campaign is careful to emphasize that it is not opposed to tax relief. It argues that the amendment goes beyond simply lowering taxes. We're not against property tax relief, the organization says. We're citizens against unintended consequences, especially those we see coming. According to the campaign, Florida homeowners deserve real property tax relief, but the amendment does more than offer relief. It often puts local solutions on a collision course with a financial iceberg, limiting the ability of counties and cities to respond to the real costs of public safety, infrastructure needs, storm recovery, and services that support our quality of life. The group argues that locking these restrictions into the state constitution would tie the hands of local governments, making it harder for them to adapt to changing financial needs. Instead of changing the Constitution, the campaign says Florida should look for other ways to provide property tax relief. The problem with the proposed amendment is not relief, the group said. It is relief without a responsible replacement plan. On its website, the group has posted a policy paper called A Ballot That Buries the Cost, along with local government impact data and an analysis titled The Tax Shift. The goal is to get voters to take a hard look at how the amendment could affect cities and counties across Florida. Rather than building a typical political machine, the committee says it wants to spark conversations among voters about what's at stake. We're a whole mess of R's, D's, NPAs, PTAs, HOAs, and the rest of the alphabet who call Florida home, the website says. You don't need a title or political experience to make a difference. For this group, success means Floridians having informed discussions about the amendment, not just winning political points. Florida is not performing well when it comes to managing food assistance money. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released its fiscal 2025 Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program payment error rates that measure how accurately states determine who qualifies for SNAP and how much they should receive. Florida's error rate for 2025 was 12.97%, which covers both overpayments and underpayments. The national payment error rate average for fiscal year 2025 is 10.62%. The 12.9% is also more than double the federal threshold of 6% that Congress says is acceptable. The result is that the state will have to pay nearly a $1 billion penalty and subsequently could impact the 3 million mostly lower income Floridians who rely on that program. Florida is now required to submit a corrective action plan to the USDA detailing a solution. The change is part of President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill that focused on finding waste, fraud, and abuse in numerous federal programs. The Florida Policy Institute, a nonprofit research and advocacy group, called the change a massive cost shift from the federal government to the state. Now, unless Florida lawmakers act to raise revenue to preserve SNAP and make up for the loss in federal funds, we will see cuts to the SNAP program eligibility or benefits or cuts in other areas in the state budget, said Holly Bullard, FPI's chief strategy and development officer. In Florida, in the first 5 months since the bill took effect, participations in SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, has dropped by about 10% statewide, more than 277,000 people. You're listening to WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WVPV, LP 100.1.